Should the UK be investing in HS2 when the country's broadband infrastructure is so bad and letting down small and medium-sized businesses and stopping them growing and competing in the global economy?
Well, I think we need both. We need the highest quality transport network that we can get, but also we can't compete unless we complete the broadband challenge, and we're not there and we're getting behind on getting to 100% broadband. On HS2, I've been clear, and Labour's been clear, we'll support the plan, the first stage to Crewe going through the Commons at the moment. There's a debate about getting the best route for the second phase, but the important thing is got to be value for money. We've got to keep the costs under control. I've been clear there's no blank check for me. We will go ahead on the basis that the sums add up and it's value for money. But on broadband, we can't afford to fall behind, and we are at the moment.
You had a bit of a wobble on HS2 a year ago, is it fair to say, Shadow Chancellor? You weren't entirely convinced?
I said there's no blank check. And at that time, the costs were going up billions by billions by billions. And the government has tried to get a grip on the costs, and they've made some progress. But on the second phase, I think there's been too much focus on only linking Manchester and the north to London. We've also got to think about Hull to Liverpool. The connections east to west are just as important. The Chancellor says he wants to have High Speed 3 after High Speed 2. But why should we wait to connect across the north for 10, 20, 30 years? We should get on and do that as soon as we can, in my view.
Anthony, happy with that answer?
But how much are you committing to HS2 to compare to how much you're committing to broadband?
Well, on broadband, we've got to get to 100%. We should have been there by 2012, and we're not going to be there by 2015.
In monetary terms, how much are you committing to, how much are you prepared or comfortable to spend on HS2 compared to spending on broadband?
Well, what we've got to do on HS2 in the first phase is make sure this comes within the budgets that the government has set. But for the decade after that, at the moment, it's still very unclear what the numbers are. We're talking on HS2 about spending tens of billions in 10, 15 years' time. On broadband, it's spending the money in the next 3 or 4 years. So I think we can get the broadband done well before we're spending on the second phase of HS2.
Let's move on. Thanks, Anthony.
Sorry?
Let's move on to...
We will deliver on broadband because, look, we were the guys who set the target. The current government has fallen behind and we've got to get back on track because at the moment it's not good enough.
OK, Sue, we have a question for Mr.
Yes.
Balls.
With Labour and Liberals' proposals to introduce the mansion tax, there's a huge difference between the North and the South. Mm. And for people that have owned their houses for decades in the South, are going to be penalised very heavily. There is, to me, a completely unmanageable scheme, and it's a wrong tax, in my opinion. What are you going to do to level that out so that...
Sure. Well, look, I didn't come into politics to levy a mansion tax. It was never part of my reason for being. But the problem we've got is our health service is going backwards. It's underfunded. People are paying a lot more tax already. And what we know is the highest value properties are paying a lot less tax than ordinary properties, much less council tax compared to their value. We've said across the UK, it's a UK tax, any property over £2 million will pay this extra tax. Between £2 and £3 million, it's £250 a month. Anybody who is an ordinary basic rate taxpayer up to £42,000 will have to pay nothing in year. They can pay it later. So there'll be no question of anybody being forced out of their homes. But in the end, I've got to say, at a time when the deficit's huge and the NHS is in real need, we've got to ask those people with the broader shoulders to make a bit more of a contribution. So many of these homes, not all of them, so many are owned now by international investors who've come in from abroad. I think they should pay a fair share of tax so we can save our NHS.
I think we'd all agree with that, and I think some, particularly for the international and all these different loopholes, I see this a lot in my business. But there again, why don't you offer tax relief for, say, private health? Because that would take a lot of pressure off the NHS, wouldn't it?
Sure.
So you could introduce that.
In the end, I'm afraid, anybody who gets really sick or has a real problem comes to the NHS because that is the highest quality, better alternative. And look, I can't afford to spend tax relief money helping people go private when we've got so a shortage of doctors and nurses. Actually, when we came to government, we got rid of the tax relief on private medical insurance in 1997 because we thought that was the wrong priority. What I'm saying to people with very large properties, over £2 million, this is a very, very small proportion of properties. You know, this will be done in a careful way, in a considered way, between £2 and £3 million, just £250 a month. But I think it's fair to save the NHS.
Do you think, when Jim Murphy said that the mansion tax on London would be used to fund nurses in Scotland, that's not the most helpful thing for you, is it? Is that an argument you believe in?
Look, it's a UK tax. It will apply to properties right across the UK over £2 million.
There aren't any properties.
There are, Faisal, across the UK. But you're right to say that the people with the largest houses and the greatest wealth tend to be further south. And there's a shortage of nurses and doctors everywhere in the UK. We've said we'll have 20,000 more nurses, 8,000 more GPs, 5,000 more care workers, because the NHS is going backwards. And we need nurses and doctors in London and in Glasgow and in Cardiff and in Manchester and in Newcastle. And it's a fair thing to say that those with the largest properties and the greatest value should make a contribution so we can save the NHS.
Let's move on to another question. We've got a question from, I think, from Facebook. Is that going to come? Yes, OK. Alan Patterson is asking, when will we get an apology for the state Labour left this country in?
Well, I've made an apology on the issue of bank regulation. We all know that countries around the world, including in Britain, we weren't regulating the banks in a tough enough way. But what actually happened was, it wasn't simply the ministers, the politicians, the central bank governors. The bank chief executives themselves didn't know what was going on within their institutions, and that caused huge problems around the world. Now, George Osborne and the Conservatives want to say it was all Labour's fault and it was caused by public spending. When Lehman Brothers went bankrupt in New York, it wasn't because of nurses and doctors and police officers here in Britain. It was a global crisis which started in America, but at its root was a lack of tough regulation. We should have been tougher. So I'm sorry about that. Actually, my opponent, George Osborne, he continually criticised me, Faisal, as you know, because he said I was being too tough on the banks. He said I was going to undermine jobs by scaring banks away. Why can't you be softer on regulation? And he was wrong too.
So sorry about that. Anyone want to come back on that? This is a key issue. Gentleman over there.
Hello, Ian Allen from GM in the UK. In terms of where we are now compared to where we were 5 years ago, how do you think we operate on the world stage at the moment as a player?
Sure.
What are we good at now? What do we need to improve on?
Well, I was in America just a few weeks ago at the White House and at the US Treasury, and the number one thing people were saying to me in government and in business was, is Britain really thinking of leaving the European Union in the next 5 years, having a referendum and leaving? That would be a disaster for American investment into Britain. It would undermine British influence. They couldn't believe we were considering this. So I think at the moment, we're actually playing fast and loose with something very important, our standing in Europe, and we're undermining our influence when we ought to be banging the table for reform in Europe. So at the moment, I don't think we're being listened to as much as we should be. The reality is we've got some great companies, we've got some brilliant universities, we lead the world in culture and media, our television programmes sell all around the world, but we can do better. And what I would like to see us do is do better in winning global markets. But if you walk away from your big single market on your doorstep, we walk away from Europe, are Nissan and Toyota and Honda going to stay in Britain? Or are they going to think, well, actually, if they're leaving the single market we want to be part of, maybe we should go to Spain? I think it's a really, really risky moment for our country the next few years.
You're from a car company. Do you agree with that?
Far be it from us to tell how our customers how to vote or even our employees how to vote. You know, I think the SMMT, which is our trade body, gave a clear message from the car industry that the vast majority of businesses want the country to stay in Europe.
But you'd agree with me that Europe can do better. It needs reform. The euro's not doing well enough. We waste some public spending. The single market could be more effective. But the way to be influential is to be in there making your case. And if you spend your whole time saying to our European partners, we're thinking of leaving, then they discount us when we actually should be influential to change the way Europe's going.
Most definitely. Gold plating regulation isn't the way to attract.
Just quickly, a couple of comments
on this.
But also
the Americans are very keen to trade with Britain because we are so successful compared with Germany, compared with France and many other nations in Europe. So that's why they want us to stay there, because we're stable and we're way ahead of the other countries
I hear what you're saying, but that's not what people in America say to me. They say Britain is important to America as part of the European Union, influencing it in a good direction. And American companies like Ford, they want to be in Britain selling into that European market. The evidence I hear from America is people saying that for this country to walk away from Europe in the next 5 years would be risky and dangerous, not just for Britain, but for American and French and German and Japanese companies as well. So, look, I'm all for being influential, and I'm all for leading the world, but don't cut off your nose to spite your face.
Quick comment from here on that same issue.
Just a quick question. In terms of Europe, are you saying no matter how bad it got, you'd stay in?
I want to stay in, but I want to win the argument. And my experience of Europe, I was in the Treasury for a number of years, I've been in politics and the economy for 20 years, is that if people think you're serious and you're committed and you're going to make a good argument, in the end, you can get your way. Britain can be influential in Europe. We can change the way things are going. But if Europe decides that you're not serious, that you're playing politics, that you're actually just playing a game and that you're kind of trying to placate your backbenchers in the House of Commons, they give up on you. We cannot afford to let people in Europe think Britain is given up on the jobs and the investment which comes from being part of Europe. And I am an optimist. I think outside the single currency, because I was one of the important people who stopped us joining the single currency 10 years ago. I don't think we should join the euro, but I am an optimist. We can be outside the euro and still win for Britain in Europe. And that's the important thing we've got to do.
Let's move on. Another question from social media, from Facebook, Alexandra Horowitz. What are your plans to help first-time home buyers?
I think the most important thing we've got to do is to build more homes, more affordable homes, homes in places people want to live. I think one of the big mistakes the government made a couple of years ago was to abolish the presumption that you would build on brownfield sites first, because that's actually where people want to live in the cities, is where the land is. And part of the reason why the government's been pretty bad at getting the house building numbers through is because the developers are saying, well, we don't want to go brownfield, let's go to the greenfield land on the edge of the towns and the cities. That's actually where you can only build expensive houses and you run into big planning problems. So the answer is, in the end, you can't make housing affordable for first-time buyers unless you get more homes being built. Now, George Osborne has said he wants to help people to save for a deposit, and that's fine by me, but you can only afford a deposit and a mortgage if the house prices are actually related to your income.
They trebled under the Labour government in real terms. It was on your watch.
I think that in the early years of the Labour government, we didn't build enough homes. I totally agree. When we came in 1997, there were loads of houses in our country, council houses, with no bathroom inside, roofs which are leaking. We said, let's sort out the existing houses, a 19 billion backlog, but I don't think we built enough homes. We were turning that round 10 years ago. The financial crisis clearly has made that harder. There's no question about that. But have we at the moment got a plan to build more homes? We say 200,000 more homes a year by the end of the decade. It's a really difficult objective. I think we can deliver it, but it will require a big push from government.
Lady over there.
Why are you concentrating on building new homes when you're losing private housing stock through the sharing economy and Airbnb? Shouldn't you start there?
Well, I think it's all of those things. I think that you need to make sure. We now have, I think, 11 million people who live in the private rented sector, often in quite difficult conditions, often on really short tenancies. So we can improve conditions and rights for people who are private renters. I do think that it's frustrating when you see councils selling off council housing. On the other hand, I don't want to say to people who've saved they shouldn't be able to buy their home. When I get told by people in my party we shouldn't be supporting that, I disagree, because I want people to be able to buy their home. In the end, though, I think what all the experts say is whatever else we do, we've got to build more homes, more affordable homes. And I think that is a big strategic challenge for our country. It's important for young people, but actually for businesses, it's a big deal as well.
If you can't, we're losing existing stock at the moment because people are renting out their homes for commercial use. And so we're actually in our city centres losing existing stock.
Well, you're right. There's been a huge rise in the number of people renting over the last few years. And that is, for some people, a good choice. For some people, it's a forced choice because they've got to rent while they are saving for a mortgage. If in the end you can get house prices to a more realistic level compared to earnings, more people will be able to buy homes again. I was able to save for a deposit and buy a house in my late 20s, 20 years ago. I think it's really hard for people in their late 20s now because in the end, the prices are just so high compared to earnings. And that is in the end, look, economics is about supply and demand. Unless you get the supply up, build more homes, it's going to be really hard for many people to afford it.
Let's move on. Sue for a question. Sue Tepelowski. Sue, OK.
Business rates is a failing tax and it is now stopping growth and apprenticeships. In my own company, I'm going to have to downsize because of business rates. So what can you do to help businesses on this front?
Well, I think you're right to talk about the long-term challenge. Let me say, first of all, for small businesses, in my constituency, high levels of business rates is a huge problem on the high street. What we've said we're going to do when we come in, we're not going to have the next cut in the main corporation tax rate for large companies. Instead, we're going to use that money to cut business rates by 1% and then freeze them for a second year for any business with a property which is less than £50,000. That's 1.5 million properties in our country. We think that would give an average tax cut of £470 to a small business. That will help lots of small businesses, but it doesn't solve the underlying problem. So we also need to be thinking, well, what are we going to do? If you think about Sainsbury's or Next, big companies, they're competing against online retailers who may actually have their warehouses outside of Britain. They can avoid paying business rates and they're still competing and the playing field isn't level. So I think it's right that we ask some big questions for the long term about whether or not there's a better way to do this. At the moment, the business rates system was based upon a view of commerce which is quite 20th century, and we're in the 21st century now.
So could you cut business rates, or could you cut something like VAT? I mean, there isn't the physical
As I've
space.
Said, for small companies, we'll have a 1% cut and then freeze for a year, and that will help 1.5 small businesses immediately. But for the medium term, we need to ask some big questions. The reality is, it's expensive. And I've not got a big pot of money, obviously. The deficit from George Osborne is going to be £90 billion, and our NHS is under real pressure. So I've not got an easy solution. I think we need to look hard at this. The government's announced a review, but I think some people feel the Treasury are using that to sort of stall the issue. I want to take this review seriously and ask with business some big long-term questions about the way in which business rates is working. But in the short term, an immediate cut.
We have to push on. We have to push on to another issue. Kevin.
Just to bring you back on the deficit, the £90 billion deficit is huge. You said it's huge.
Sure.
Your deficit was over £150 billion.
Sure.
We need to address the deficit, yet you want to take the austerity measures and tone them down.
Sure.
Why?
What I want to do is balance the budget is cut the deficit every year to get the budget balance in the next parliament and the national debt falling.
The deficit is bigger than Spain, Portugal and Ireland.
And, look, the challenge I've got is that David Cameron and George Osborne, they said they'd get rid of it by this year, and they haven't. It's still £90 billion.
Better than you got it, though, isn't it?
Well, look, it's come down, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing it's come down. And it was coming down under Labour and in the early part of the last decade. Then it went up because of the global financial recession. And it's coming down again. We need to cut the deficit every year. We need to balance the budget in the next Parliament. But we've got to do so in a steady and careful way. At the moment, George Osborne said last week he's going to have cuts in the next 3 years in public spending, which are deeper than in the last 5 years. I think most people think what we've seen already to our defence forces, to our police officers, to our NHS has been pretty tough, even deeper in the next 3 years than the last 5 years. I'm not sure that's going to be possible to deliver. That's why I say a more careful and balanced plan, some action on taxes at the top, as we talked about earlier. We'd put the top rate of income tax back up to 50p for people earning over £150,000.
How much do you think that will raise?
I think it will raise a significant amount of money. It's been...
Can you put a number on significant?
Well, yeah. the gross cost of the cut from 50 to 45p was £3 billion. That was how much was given to people. But obviously, there's lots of avoidance...
in an economy where we spend £720 billion a year. Sure. This is tinkering around the edges. When are you going to do the big stuff?
I think, as you know, and if you're in business, you'll understand, £3 billion is a large amount of money. And what I've
in a 1.6 trillion economy, in a government that spends £720 billion, £3 billion is zero. When are you going to do the big stuff?
What I'm going to do is get the economy growing more strongly, have some fair changes on taxation at the top. I'm going to do some difficult things, like the winter allowance will restrict for the highest income pensioners, and also we're going to have a real focus on more good skilled jobs. If we were to get the economy to grow by just 0.2% a year more in the next few years, then by 2020 we'd have a £15 billion saving in the deficit. That's a big amount of money, and that's actually something which is achievable if you've got a proper industrial plan.
Let's move on. Jules White, question on entrepreneurship. Jules.
Hi, Jules.
Hi, Jules White from The Last Saddle. So SMEs make up 99% of the British economy. Only 18% of those businesses are headed up by women. What are you going to do to encourage more female entrepreneurs?
Well, I think, first of all, it's got to start in the schools. I've got two daughters, 15 and 10, and I want them to be told in school that they have got just as much right and talent and ability and opportunity to be a scientist, an engineer or a small business owner as the boys. And I think we've got more to do as a society to get that message to our young people in schools, primary and secondary, that gender should make no difference to your ambition and to your opportunity. Then we've got to make sure that when we're thinking about numbers of apprenticeships for 18-year-olds, school leavers who might use an apprenticeship to start a business, that that those are available for boys and girls equally. And we should try to make sure that girls are taking up the apprenticeships. And then when you're thinking about banks, how they operate, the British Investment Bank, which we're going to set up to lend to small businesses, I think it's right that we're saying we want to be lending to focus on supporting women who want to grow and expand businesses. The reality is, if you actually look at the numbers in Britain and in America, that very many of the most dynamic, most successful businesses in our country have been set up and run by women. In my constituency, a fabulous business which makes wigs just down the road from my office. Brilliant business, expanding very fast. But I think there's more we can do to break some of the cultural views in banks and in schools which say, well, you know, maybe that's not something for women. It's ridiculous.
A question, follow-up.
The issue's a little bit deeper, isn't it? The young lady over there mentioned earlier that zero contract hours are predominantly aimed at women and those that are older. So why is that? What's wrong with the society? What are you going to do with that issue?
Sure.
Why not encourage those people that are being really violated and you know, they're just taken advantage of?
Personally, I think it's gone too far, what's happened with zero-hours contracts. A huge rise, 400,000 more in the last year alone. And we want to have a labour market which creates jobs and works in a flexible way. But if that means that all the risk is actually being borne by lower-paid, vulnerable people who are not finding out day-to-day whether they're going to earn, whether they'll have money to pay the bills, that's not fair. And we've said we're not going to outlaw all zero-hours contracts because there are, for some people, especially higher skill, certain kind of professional people, where it can make real sense. But for very many people, it's exploitative. And we're going to change the rules. So, for example, if you have been on a zero-hours contract but working effectively regular hours for 6 months, you should have the right to move to a proper regular contract rather than being stuck on a zero-hours contract. In a year, that should happen automatically. And we're also saying to people on zero-hours contracts, if you're told by an employer that you have to be on 0 hours but you can't work for anybody else, well, that should be against the law, because people shouldn't be stuck without the ability to work but told by the employer, if you don't stick with me, then I'll take away your contract. There's things we can do to make this better and fairer, and I actually think the business community now understands on 0 hours contracts it's gone too far.
Tanya, just a quick question from your question on farming, Tanya. We've just
Thank
got
you.
2 minutes.
Self-sufficiency. Our country's ability to feed itself with home-produced food is on a downward spiral. If, I take it, you would be in favour of reversing that, what would your government do to help back British farming?
I'm all for backing British farming, but the reality is we are part of a open global economy, and it's good that we have international trade. And international trade means that there's some kind of products. If you go to the supermarket, you can buy a much wider range of produce and also often at cheaper prices because of international trade. And for people who are struggling to make ends meet with living standards under pressure, that's a good thing. So I'm for international trade. I don't like the common agricultural policy because I think it costs consumers quite a lot. What we've got to do is help our farmers in order to keep upgrading their produce, their equipment, their productivity. That's the only way for them to stay ahead of the competition. So when you talk about industrial policy, that should be for agriculture as well as for pharmaceuticals.